Hello, I'm Matt Maitham, Deputy Editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Today, I'm joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
And contributor, Leila Latif.
Hi.
This week, we've got an extraordinary variety of films to cover, including Emergency, Benediction, Aha! The Movie, The Innocents, and Chippendale Rescue Rangers. So there is a lot of terrain to cover there. But first up, what have you guys been watching or listening to this week?
Yeah, I've been watching as much television as humanly possible, as per usual. it's a bit of a dip at the moment, actually, because there isn't a new Marvel show coming out every week. But there's still two very good shows. Barry, which is on season three, which is back after a really long break, where Bill Hader's playing a guy who's a very good hitman and a very bad actor. And that's still really funny and fun. And then The Shining Girls on Apple TV Plus. Really enjoying that. I think one of my favorite things is always when you get a child actor in kind of a really good like horror role. Jamie Bell, who young Billy Elliot, is playing a kind of serial killer with who's got like some supernatural powers, and he's absolutely like terrifying in it, which is, yeah, I love it when Elijah Wood goes evil as well.
I do want to catch both of these. I've never seen any Barry, I haven't seen any of the previous series, but I hear only good things, so I must catch up.
I think if you like the funnier episodes of Breaking Bad, it's about kind of that tone. Henry Winkler, who plays a really despicable acting coach, is really funny in it. And also, I think just watching people being bad actors is also very, very funny.
Yeah. And how about you, Matthew? What have you been watching?
There's been some new trailers. Prey, just kind of a tease, isn't it, really?
But, very much a tease, yeah. But I am excited. Yeah. I like the concept of it. Yeah. As we've had a lot of Predator reboots, it's nice that they're doing something a bit different with it.
Do you think they'll have to take that song in it, though? I mean, I was kind of
expecting. Wait, it's spelt different. It's spelt differently.
Yeah. Philip Jordan Peele was making that. He'd do a really clever, slowed down, creepy version of the Take That song.
Yeah, lots of topless action on the beach. Yeah, and the She-Hulk trailer.
Which latest dropped out of nowhere.
Novel. Yeah, I wasn't expecting that.
What did you think of it?
I'm excited. I know there's been a bit of a backlash about the CGI, but I'm excited about just about seeing that character, because I've liked that character for a long time, and it was like it's long overdue that she's reached the screen. So I thought it looked kind of fun. Looks like it's kind of tapped into the vibe of the comics, the kind of the comedy and the action. I always think She-Hulk's a lot less angsty than actual Hulk in the original Hulk, so. Yeah, I'm kind of looking forward to it.
It's subtitled She-Hulk Attorney at Law as well. Is that true to the comics?
Yeah, there are. So yeah, some of the best comics in recent years have really focused on her legal activities. So it's not just a load of smashing, but there's courtroom drama as well.
And what did you think of it, Leila?
Oh, I don't know. I think that CGI was a bit uncanny valley for me. Kind of a bit human, but not human. And I suppose you can get like used to these things as you watch it, but I was a bit disappointed, I have to say. But you know, I've been wrong before. I didn't think I was gonna like Hawkeye, and I did.
Same.
But yeah, a bit nervous having watched that trailer that it's gonna be a bit of a car crash, but you know, hopefully not.
Yeah, because I did wonder before we kind of saw anything on it, I wondered how much Hulk we'd actually get because of being TV and obviously the budget's not being quite the same as films. Yeah. But it seems like we'll get quite a lot, obviously. And yes, I was also very unsure on the CGI, and that seemed to be what the majority of my Twitter feed was saying as well when it dropped. Mm. But again, maybe it will settle in. Maybe, as they often say when trailers first come out, that there's still sort of some finessing to do on the effects, so maybe they'll look different when it's finished. And I suppose it's a tricky one because she doesn't look as different as like Bruce does when he transforms, and he transforms into a sort of much more cartoony character, really, doesn't he, with his big square head. But maybe it's, I don't know, maybe it becomes uncanny because, you know, it looks quite similar to what she sort of really looks like.
Yeah.
A bit bigger and a bit greener.
I was messaging with fellow contributor Josh Slater Williams, and he said, why does she look like a Republican senator? She does have that giant hair, doesn't she? And it's very, it's a bit odd. Some of the jokes I thought felt a bit kind of, I don't know, a bit dated, a bit kind of, you know, oh look, and she's a lady, and like, you know, it's all about how kind of like hot a body she has and stuff. But you know, I've been fooled by trailers in the past, so I'm going to try and keep an open mind.
They do love an 80s font, don't they, Marvel, at the moment? Mm. Like with that and Love and Thunder, they're really kind of digging into that, that 80s neon vibe, sort of Michael Mann style.
Do like that, though.
Yeah,
I do like that.
I'm not going to complain about that. And lastly, just before we kick off properly on this week's reviews, the Cannes Film Festival has officially begun now. Obviously, none of us are there, sadly, this year. Jordan is there for us doing, you know, the Lord's work out there. But are there any films at the festival this year that you're particularly looking forward to?
There's one called Silent Twins that I'm really interested in. That's from the director who, I can't remember her name, but she directed that kind of really weird musical horror film about mermaids called The Lure.
So
she's got a new kind of, it sounds a bit like a true crime thriller about a real thing that happened in the 80s, that there were a pair of black twins in a little village in Wales who only ever spoke to one another, and then they kind of become serial arsonists.
Oh, wow.
And I listened to an NPR thing about it years ago, and it's just the weirdest story, and I think it would make a really great film.
How about you, Matthew?
I can't remember what it's called, but the new Park Chan-wook. Yeah, I'm excited to see that. And Cronenberg, although a bit scared from what he's been saying. So I'm going to cry or vomit or pass out. but well up for Crimes of the Future.
Yeah, Crimes of the Future would be my hot ticket there for sure. I just absolutely love Cronenberg and very, very, very excited to see him go back to his kind of disturbing, fleshy sort of side. Mm. So that's my top pick. So Jordan has lots to look forward to, and he's tweeting and everything about it. So follow him and follow Total Film to see what he's seeing while he's out there. And so now we're going to turn our attention to the films you can watch this week, starting with this.
There's an unconscious white girl in our living room.
What?
Emma! You've seen Emma.
Emma since we got here.
Okay, she's alive. We should call 911.
Hey, stop! Are you crazy?
We didn't do anything wrong.
We don't have to do nothing wrong, Kool-Aid. The cops are not gonna listen. They just gonna come in here and see three brown guys hanging over this little white girl.
We looked everywhere, and we can track her on your phone.
We can't just leave her somewhere. We take her to the hospital.
Shotgun.
That was Emergency. Layla, can you set up Emergency for us, please?
So this is about two young college students called Sean and Kunle. They're two young black guys at a university, and it's sort of the end of the year and there's a lot of parties going around. And so they decide that they're going to do this sort of, it seems like a party crawl around like frat houses. I think it must be a very American thing because I don't remember this. It's from university. And they've got a Latino flatmate called Carlos, who kind of they're considering whether or not they should bring him along. So it's kind of in the spirit of like a Book Smart or a Super Bad, you know, kind of also over like one crazy night where everybody just wants to have a good time and things get going in the way. The only thing is, because these are like young men of color, when they come across a teenage girl who's completely drunken and passed out, rather than just be able to like call the police and be like, oh, please come and help us, they're really worried that they're going to end up kind of on the wrong end of a policeman's gun. So it makes the whole thing way more stressful and the stakes are a lot higher because they're not able to kind of do the sort of things that, you know, just a character in Booksmart or Superbad or American Graffiti, whatever, would be able to do automatically. So it's kind of that comedy, but it's got that like Safdie Brothers, very, very stressful thriller kind of element to it.
And so did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I really enjoyed this. This was the first film that I watched at this year's Sundance, and I felt like it's got me off to a really, really good start. I think it's like genuinely really funny and fun. Mm. I liked RJ Seiler a lot from The Harder They Fall. He's kind of like the young gunslinger, and I just think he's really, really charismatic and witty and funny. And I really love the relationship between all three of the guys, but particularly Sean and Kunle, that Sean is much more kind of street smart and outrageous, and Kunle, you know, just believes that if he behaves himself and follows all of the rules, everything will work out. And they kind of explore maybe that, you know, there's a fallacy about that, that you can do all of the right things as a young black man and things can kind of, you know, not to spoil things, but, you know, still be in difficult situations, shall we say. But yeah, I think it was really smart and really funny and really fun.
And how about you, Matthew? Did you like it?
I did, yeah. I found it maybe a little bit uneven sort of in the middle. I felt like when they were kind of moving getting everybody into place, sort of moving all the pieces around the chessboard. I mean, I thought, like, you know, the setup's very kind of involving and interesting. But yeah, maybe perhaps in the middle, a bit of a dip, but then it kind of really, really escalates and gets incredibly gripping and tense and emotional as well. Certainly, you know, towards the end. And I really kind of engaged with those characters, the two main characters. I felt sort of quite sad at the end. I wanted to see them again. You know, I'd love to see a sequel or some sort of follow-up, because they have such a lovely chemistry together, so well played. And I really like the direction as well, the balancing of the tones, you know, the way it is it can be very funny and very dramatic and tense, and then sometimes both at the same time. So it's got a really well-handled tone to it. And it is a comedy that has something to say as well, which does feel quite rare at times, especially in American comedies, things that do have a real sort of social resonance as well as being entertaining and making you laugh. I don't think it's his debut, but it's incredibly promising calling card.
I think he had one last year that was called like #J, which was like a social media version of Romeo and Juliet. And I just thought that sounded horrendous, so I didn't watch that.
Yeah, I'd not heard of that.
No, I had not. So this is a good place to start if you want to explore the films of Kerry Williams, let's say. Because I haven't seen all the films this week, but this is one of the ones I have seen. And yeah, I pretty much just agree with you guys that I really enjoyed it. It was kind of, it's gripping, it's sort of funny, but very, very kind of stressfully tense a lot of the time as well. But then also, there is this real sort of like warmth between the characters, and also the kind of the dynamic with Carlos as well, the roommate that Layla mentioned as well. There's some kind of, interesting things going on there. And like those films Layla mentioned, like Booksmart and Superbad, they obviously really do depend on the chemistry between the leads and you kind of buying into that friendship, which you really do here. So yeah, it's just very, very entertaining. And I very much recommend this film.
I did find myself kind of quite a while afterwards just being like, I wonder what Carlos is up to, because I just thought he was such an endearing character. It's just like, I'm really rooting for that guy, that fictional guy.
Yeah. He's such a sweet character, isn't he? Just like him straight away.
And that kind of that third wheel sort of side of him, there's just, some nice moments with that, And just felt very, very sort of believable. And I really brought all of the three of them together, their friendship.
And there's a bit, I won't spoil it obviously, but there's a bit towards the end where a character's talking about their experience with near death. And it just felt really rare to get that in a film, because, in films so often you see characters kind of being nearly killed and just kind of brushing it off, moving on to the next thing. But he really kind of, there's real sort of reflection on how close he was and the fear he feels, this character. And I just found that really, really moving and just such a rare thing to see, really, and certainly in a comedy anyway. It really does have that kind of depth to it.
Yeah, you do feel that this could be like kind of a star-making turn if enough people see it from RJ. Well, I suppose RJ Sell is doing pretty well already, but from Donald Watkins as well. Yeah. But you do worry sometimes about like stuff going on to Amazon Prime, because I think even though that does, I think that does mean that everybody involved makes a good amount of money, I'd assume. Sometimes things just kind of disappear on Amazon Prime and they don't really make the impact that they would maybe if they were on Netflix or in the cinemas.
Yeah, it's odd, isn't it? Yeah,
things, they can get lost in the mix, can't they?
Yeah, they just don't trend as much, do they, as Netflix or Disney Plus?
If you like the sound of that anyway, it is having a limited theatrical release from this Friday, the 20th of May, and then it's out globally on Amazon Prime Video from the 27th of May next week. So, it's there. So do seek it out. It's very much worth a watch. Yeah, whether you catch it in the cinema or on Prime, just don't let it pass you by.
And it's also short, which I think like that's what everybody's talking about at the moment, isn't it? Like we like nice 90 minute films. I don't know if it is 90 minutes, but it zips by.
And as we've said, it really packs a lot into that time as well. So you get a lot of kind of bang for your buck, a lot of a good return on investment on those 90 or so minutes. On to the next one now. So following that very modern thriller, we're now going to go back in time with this.
Who is this extremely beautiful young man?
Sassoon Siegfried.
Sounds Wagnerian.
I'm anxious to meet our distinguished guest. All the fine young cannibals.
What should I do about my hair?
Have you considered topiary?
It's one of the inconveniences of the shadow life we lead. Friends may come,
Friends may go. Enemies are always faithful.
Matthew, what's Benediction about?
This is the latest from Terence Davis, the esteemed veteran British director. He did a biopic of Emily Dickinson a couple of years back. And now he's done another poet biopic, this time of Siegfried Sassoon, who's played in his youth as a soldier by Jack Loudon, and as the older version by Peter Capaldi. And the film kind of goes back and forth in time, goes back from his World War One experiences, and then to the later years with Capaldi. I mean, it's mostly Jack Loudon who carries the movie. And we follow his experiences, kind of his growing anti-war sentiment and his relationships, in particular with his Ivan Novello, who's played by Jeremy Irvine. We see him in his later life as well, being not so happy. He's married, but he's very discontent. It's quite sort of fragmented in its way, which is kind of we're sort of used to with Terence Davis. He has done several other films with that sort of fragmented nature. So it's quite unconventional, I suppose, for a biopic. It's not a sort of straight cradle to grave story. I struggled with it a little bit in places. I did find it very long. I mean, it's over 2 hours, but I thought the performances were very strong, especially from Loudon and what we get of Peter Capaldi.
How about you, Lady? Did you like this film?
Yeah, I really liked it. I absolutely love Jack Loudon. I'm very much campaign Jack Loudon for Bond. I think he's just so charismatic and just wonderful, wonderful actor. I'm very fond of Terence Davies. I've found this almost unbearably sad as films go. World War One is so sad, all these doomed love affairs, kind of, you know, being gay at the time that Siegfried Sassoon was obviously a very difficult thing. I was less invested when we went forward to Peter Capaldi as older Siegfried Sassoon, that's a tricky one. who's like having a bit of a crisis of faith and will he turn to Catholicism or not? But that could just be me being as big of a Jack Loudon fan as I am, that I was like, when's he coming back? But I thought it was just like really beautifully composed. I do agree it is a little overlong, but once it was kind of over, I just felt that I'd had like a very like beautiful, rich dessert. I think it's just like a really gorgeous film. And Terence Davies, he's almost like watching kind of somebody do like an old oil painting or something. Like it's kind of just so skillful, I suppose, in a very like classic way. It's really upsetting. I was kind of a bit hesitant to rewatch it for the podcast because I first watched it last year because I knew I'd be sad again. But I think it's a great film.
So is it one of those films that really kind of leaves you feeling sad, you know, like is it kind of leave you a bit broken afterwards?
There's sort of everything about it is sad. Like all the people, all those young men that died in World War One is sad, you know, people having a crisis of faith. The idea of like what gay people have gone through is very sad. Like, you know, his marriage being so dissatisfying is very sad. The kind of love that he could have had, his poems, which you hear quite a lot during this, you know, often with like footage. I think it's archive footage. I think it's not something they made for the film, kind of old black and white footage. That's terribly sad. So yeah,
there's a lot of unhappiness in this movie.
Does it feel like one of those period films that sort of is speaking to today, or does it feel like it's very much, you know, just a portrait of the past?
Yeah, it's definitely relevant to today. I mean, it's kind of, I think it's another sad thing about it, about how certain things haven't really moved on in a lot of ways since that time. I mean, it's kind of a portrait of a gay culture as well of that time, which we haven't really seen before. That's nice because that is so rare. But yeah, it does feel, and certainly with war as well, I mean, it does sadly feel quite irrelevant, really.
Yeah, all of the anti-war stuff is a bit of a punch in the heart.
Because
it's just this idea of all these like young men and like, what's it all for? And I guess that's what Siegfried Sassoon's like, that's what his poems were about. I didn't know much about his poetry beforehand, but yeah.
And you get Peter Capaldi complaining about modern music as well, which... I suppose comes to us all at a certain age.
Yeah, it's funny because Terence Davies, I've started following him on Instagram, which is, I really recommend. He's absolutely delightful on Instagram.
Oh, wow, I don't actually follow him.
I bet, yeah.
Yeah, he just joined, I think, to promote Benediction, but he's really fun. yeah. He just seems like such a sweet, gentle man, but he often talks about how he's had a lot of sadness in his life because he's gay and he's kind of, his family struggle to accept it, and he's, you know, religious and stuff. I think you can kind of feel that in that film. So that's another level of sadness. Terence Davies has had a sad life.
So if you are interested in all those levels of sadness, that is Benediction, which is in UK and Irish cinemas from this Friday, May 20th. And another change of pace now for this week with this Norwegian chiller.
Hold on.
Okay, so that was The Innocents. Layla, what is the premise for this film for anyone who hasn't heard of it?
So this is a film from Eskil Vogt, who is best known for working with Joachim Trier, and he recently got nominated for an Oscar because he wrote The Worst Person in the World. This one he's directed, and it like couldn't be sort of more at the other end of the spectrum, I suppose, beyond the fact that it's set in Norway. And it's about a group of children all living in a big block of like quite rundown flats. Two sisters, one of whom is nonverbal autistic, and then a little boy called Ben and another little girl with vitiligo called Aisha. And they sort of, a bit like in the film Chronicle, discover that they have something approaching superpowers, which gets stronger and stronger the more they use it and the more time that they spend together. Unfortunately, also a little bit like in the film Chronicle, one of them is a bit of a sociopath. The little boy played by Sam Ashraf, who's a brilliant child actor. I was so impressed by him. He's got a really like dark side to him, and he starts using his powers in a very disturbing way. I mean, we're shown that he's a pretty disturbed child pretty early on. He's got a neglectful mother, and he tortures animals in that classic young psychopath sort of way. So yeah, there's... it's kind of down to the rest of them to try and stop him, I suppose. But it's not so much an action film like Chronicle. It's more towards the sort of supernatural thriller, slight horror bent.
Yes, because it's interesting because it is much more sort of subtle than you could expect from that premise. Because it doesn't kind of go to that sort of Chronicle extreme. It's all like, it's all very kind of slow burn and subtle and very, very sort of gradual with the powers and very ambiguous as well, which is one of the things I really liked about it. Like, I really, really enjoyed this. Did you guys like this as well?
Yeah, I found it very troubling in places. And there was, as Layla said, there's some animal abuse, which I kind of flinched quite a lot through, especially because the cat looks just like my cat. Yeah. So that was kind of an unpleasant shock to watch that.
It is very tough, yeah, if you're a cat owner, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, and there's a few other things, a few other sudden shocks. Mm. But yeah, it's incredibly well done. And the kids are all brilliant. I mean, they're such compelling child actors. And I really like the fact that there is no kind of explanation for these powers. There's no kind of digging into why this has happened. It really leaves all that aside. So it just kind of plays out as this sort of allegory for how children are really, how they behave, how they kind of negotiate the world and each other, and testing limits and discovering danger, all that kind of thing. So it does have a real sort of resonance in that way.
I think it kind of succeeds just based on how good these child actors are as well. I thought they were all really, really good, and especially they're like really young child actors. I don't know how you get kind of that sort of like natural performance out of them, but I think they were all like really exceptional. I like the way the powers manifested as well. They felt like very tangible somehow. Like they may, even though they didn't explain it, I could kind of buy into the internal logic of like how everything was operating. I like this a lot. I actually found the way it did violence like really, really upsetting at times. And I'm normally good with a Saw movie, but there's a couple of smaller things that happen in this that I've just, difficult to watch.
Because it's strange, isn't it? Because it's this was something I checked out afterwards. It's a 15, because I wondered if it might be an 18 just for the kind of animal stuff mentioned, and also just for the fact it involves children, you know. And it, I mean, in some ways it feels copyable, some of the things happen, at least. It's weird because it's not like it's super gory or anything like that, and it's in some ways it's not even truly like full-on horror. It sort of feels more kind of, I don't know, yeah, like a sinister chiller thriller, or maybe, I don't know, but I mean it definitely does veer into horror, but then at the same time it is very unsettling, despite not always being kind of super gory. And the fact, yeah, it, as well, I suppose the fact it involves children, in some ways you sort of do expect it to be, I don't know, less intense. It's rare you see a kind of a film aimed at adults that has, you know, a very largely child populated cast. That there obviously are, yeah, adults, you know, we see some parents and things in there, but it's very much from the children's perspective.
And they're not sort of sentimentalized either. No. There's no, none of that at all, which is, yeah, you don't see that very often with kids in movies. Mm.
Yeah, there's a particular thing that I thought was such a powerful thing to include, because there's the sort of our main little girl, by judging, it seems to be about six, but very little. And she's got the sister who's nonverbal autistic, and like the fact that she knows that she can't say anything, so she'll pinch her. Mm. And so there's that thing about like, oh, okay, well, this isn't a sociopathic little girl, but kids can be so cruel still.
Mm.
And yeah, that was what I found really interesting about the ambiguity here, because I've really found it hard to kind of get a read on her for a long time, because she is, yeah, just presented in this kind of, not like kind of making it simple one way or the other, not like she's not just like a kind of, you know, a good little girl or whatever, but she's also not sort of a villain. But yeah, she does do some things that are questionable, but sort of understandable for a child. And you do understand as well the fact that, because obviously her sister requires so much attention from her parents, you kind of, you know, you feel that side of it too, that she obviously feels a bit neglected, you know, as a result of their kind of circumstances. And that you get all things that from all the kind of child parent interactions I found as well, that again just added sort of complexity to it. What is, you know, on the surface a fairly simple film, and there's not loads of kind of incident in the film. It's all set within this sort of, you know, estate type, you know, tower block place that was mentioned, and they largely just go to this sort of play area and this little sort of wooded area around the back. Yeah, very, very disturbing and unsettling, and felt like it sort of stayed with me for a long time afterwards, this one as well.
Very disturbing. Not a good, my daughter's not far off this, and I'm kind of off this age, and I am a bit like, oh God, what am I doing when I send her off to school every day? Because yeah, I remember from being a kid that there are just some vicious children out there. Yeah. If you're unlucky, you kind of end up hanging out with one. And often, you know, a bit like this, because I guess there's a whole thing of it is that she sort of befriends this little boy. And when you're a little girl, you can kind of be pushed into situations that you're very uncomfortable with quite easily.
Mm.
Sort of end up accidentally participating in a cat murder.
I mean, I actually haven't seen Playground yet, but it feels almost a bit like a sort of companion piece for that in a sort of strange way, about kind of schoolyard sort of bullying and those dynamics.
And Firestarter, weirdly, we had the remake of Firestarter last week. It's like the theme seems to be running through all these films.
It very much has a sort of Stephen King vibe to it, doesn't it? Innocence.
I bet he'd love this. But he's probably on Twitter singing its praises as we speak.
Yeah,
I had to meet him though, because he was giving out terrible recipes for salmon. So I haven't seen what he's been up to.
But again, like Matthew said, I felt like this, because there is no sort of mythology to it or anything, is there? You know, it's not really explained. It so I love that kind of side to it as well, that kind of, you know, subtle sort of, you know, way it, yeah, just presents the powers, you know. So yes, and another film to highly recommend this week. The one last question I had for you guys is, do you think, I mean, I actually don't know this, I don't know if you've read about this or anything, but is the title actually riffing on the Jack Clayton film from 1961 that adapted The Turn of the Screw, or is it just coincidence? Because that's obviously what springs to mind for me when you hear The Innocents. But then there's not loads in common, but I mean, there is. It is to do with the sort of, are these kids evil or are they just kids? Yeah. But I wasn't sure. I kept meaning to look it up, but should have had a Google before I came on it. Apologies, everyone.
Yeah, they don't have that much in common though, do they?
No, I mean, just literally the fact that
those kids were way more innocent.
Scary kids.
Yeah, scary kids. A bit of ambiguity, you know.
Yeah, it's like the ineffectual adult.
As scary kid movies go, this was a pretty scary kid.
This is right up there. Yeah, right up there.
Was it called New Year's Day or New Year's Eve a few years ago? I can't remember. It was a similar sort of premise. Or it certainly had the evil kids, you know, kind of tormenting the adults. So it feels like this is something that does come round every few years.
I mean, it's a scary idea. I suppose that's why Children of the Corn keeps getting remade as well.
Yeah.
But I liked in this one that the adults were sort of off to the side, because when you are a kid, it is very much about you and your fellow kids, isn't it? You're not that bothered about what adults are up to.
Yeah, it's all weirdly reminded me of Charlie Brown as well in places, but obviously, you know, a bit harsher than Snoopy and Peanuts. But yeah, that kind of thing, kids having their own world, being a law unto themselves.
Yeah.
Being quite grown up in certain ways.
Okay, so if you like the sound of that, that is The Innocents, and that's in cinemas and on digital platforms from this Friday, 20th of May. So yeah, catch it in the cinema or rent it online. And if you think that might scare the living daylights out of you, maybe this music documentary is something you can take on instead.
Folk helt klar over hvor store de fortsatt et av de største livebandene I verden. I don't mind going through the painful bits if we can strengthen the legacy of the band.
So of course that's Aha, the movie. The title obviously does a fairly good job of setting up. But for the uninitiated, Matthew, can you set this one up for us, please?
Well, the only thing left is to do an Alan Partridge joke, because he's stuffed all my puns. But yeah, this is Aha, as in the Norwegian pop group, the Trio, who, of course, shot to fame with Take On Me in the mid-80s. This recounts their history from the early 80s up to the present day. The kind of the highs and the lows, the breakups and the getting back togethers. And there's quite a lot of focus on Take On Me as the song itself and the video, but it also does do a good job of going through the rest of their history through all their albums and songs, some of which you'll have heard of, some of which you may not have heard of. And it does catch up with them in the present day. It's quite unique among rockumentaries in that there's an awful lack of debauchery, which is quite surprising, you know, especially in the week when we've got Spinal Tap 2 being announced. It's quite ironic that you get this presentation of this trio who have seemingly led very sort of conventional lives and haven't indulged in the usual sort of rock star cliches. But there is quite a lot of creative frustration that's running through them that seems to have affected their relationships as well. So that the film has quite a strong handle on that.
I always thought of Aha as being like a one-hit wonder. Mm. I mean, obviously, Take On Me is an absolute banger.
And they did a very good Bond song as well in The Living Daylights. Yeah. That was a very good Bond song.
Yeah, they keep mentioning that, and I have just no memory of it whatsoever. I felt like it might be a bit of a, like they were gaslighting me. I'm just like,
that was one of my favourite childhood Bonds, The Living Daylights.
That's my, is my favourite, I think.
Is it?
Yeah. Well, it's the song. Cinema.
Oh, film.
The song is my favourite. Yeah.
Your favourite Bond film as well. Wow.
Probably. I don't really have a preference, but yeah, probably would go for that.
My favourite was The Spy Who Loved Me, mostly because I love that kind of thing that you could drop through and then a shark would eat you. I've not revisited it in case it's rubbish because I want to have the memory. But back to Aha. So yeah, it goes to great pains to kind of explain that you know they're not a one-hit wonder. They've been, you know, they've had 10 albums over like many decades. They're still touring. They're still doing things. There's a lot of kind of simmering resentments over who gets credit for what and stuff. I was a bit disappointed in it, but probably slightly unfairly, because I really thought that the Bross documentary that came out a couple of years ago was so funny and so weird about kind of, you know, what's life after you were an 80s pop star. And I was kind of hoping it would be a bit more kind of silly than that, but it's more serious. It kind of takes them quite seriously as a sort of musical force, which is fair enough. But I think if you're not a big Aha fan and you don't remember that Bond theme, it's, you know, not great.
That was on my list to ask you how it compared to the greatest music documentary of our time. the Bros one.
But, yeah.
So, I mean, everything's a bit disappointing to that in comparison to that. Yeah. So
I saw the guy from Bros sitting outside in the street in Soho, and I nearly screamed because I was so starstruck. But just because of the documentary, I'm like not a fan of the music at all.
Yeah, never mind that.
Yeah, it's him talking about Conkers.
Oh yeah,
which one was
it? No Conkers, sadly, no, in our half the movie.
I'm not sure, but it was one of them.
One of the greatest unintentional comedies of our time. Would you agree, Matthew? Do you think this is more one for the fans? Do you think the sort of the uninitiated could kind of get something out of it? And again, I suppose I've always seen them as perhaps a two-hit wonder, because obviously everyone knows Take On Me, and I also knew The Living Daylights from the Bond movie. But you know, do you need to be a fan, or will it kind of convert you, do you think?
Yeah, it definitely is, first and foremost, for the fans, because it's quite long as well. It's over 2 hours, which is probably a bit too long. But I think it might kind of maybe unnerve fans a little bit as well, because it does go to some sort of dark places, and you do sort of sense this kind of frustration and unhappiness between them. You sort of wonder, you know, how much is it a kind of marriage of convenience that they've stuck together all these years? So it's quite sort of upfront about all that kind of stuff.
So it's not a sort of puff piece in that sense.
No, and it goes. The music gets quite a lot darker as well as the time goes on. I mean, I know a lot of their songs, but yeah, there were a few I wasn't quite aware of, and it kind of highlights how they were sort of trying to push to be a bit more experimental. They had like clashes with their record companies over certain songs they really wanted to put out. So they kind of aspired to be a bit like Queen with Bohemian Rhapsody, and really, you know, go for sort of a dark experimental territory. But there's quite sort of some nice kind of cheering moments as well. There's quite a nice bit with Coldplay acknowledging the influence on them, which people might not be aware of. And they kind of flag up that U2 have borrowed from them as well. So there's a lot about trying to flag up their artistic integrity as well, and try to put across that they weren't, you know, just a kind of flash in the pan group as well. Even though there was an awful lot of attention on Morton, the lead singer, because of his incredible good looks. He's the sharpest cheekbones in pop. Yeah, and he still looks amazing today, but I think that did sort of maybe overshadow things a little bit. You know, he's a real sort of teen idol there for a while. So yeah, cool. I found it very well-rounded, but I don't know, if you're not so familiar with the band, you might maybe struggle with it a little bit.
Intriguing. Anyway, so that is Aha! The movie, and it's scheduled for UK-wide release in cinemas on 20th of May. So now, finally, a final film of the week, something lighthearted and family-friendly to end on, with a cartoon reboot/requel that's in keeping with the trend for all things meta this year.
Real Hollywood Story. Chippendale Rescue Rangers, the show that defined a generation and turned two unknown chipmunks into international superstars. Sometimes. But his success took Chippendale to new heights.
To many more seasons of the Rescue Rangers.
We were living the dream, dancing the Roger Rabbit with Roger Rabbit.
No one ever imagined it could all come crashing down.
So that was Chippendale Rescue Rangers, a reboot of the cartoon you may or may not have loved during your youth. Matthew, what's going on with Chippendale now?
Well, like the tagline says, it's not a reboot, it's a comeback. It's catching up with Chippendale several years after their heyday with their TV show. They've kind of they've gone their separate ways. They're not a duo anymore. But they're brought back together because one of their friends, Monterey Jack, has mysteriously disappeared. So they reluctantly reunite to try and to get him back and solve a crime case. I should point out that Chip is still sort of traditional hand-drawn animation, but Dale's has CGI surgery. So he looks a bit different than Chip. Along the way, they meet lots of cartoon friends from the past. It's all got a sort of Roger Rabbit kind of vibe going on. There's lots of little throwaway gags. Some of the characters have kind of more prominent roles. Some are just cameos as well. And the sort of principal human is Kiki Lane, who's a detective who gets involved in their case as well, helps them try to solve it. And we also have Seth Rogen as well. as a kind of he's like a sort of Viking warrior type character based on a video game. He's sort of like, but done in motion capture CGI, and his appearance is very much a commentary on CGI. So there's quite a sort of satirical element to it as well.
Well, from everything you've said, it sounds absolutely amazing. Is it?
Is it absolutely amazing?
Yeah.
No, I wasn't that big a fan of it, I'm afraid. It did feel like it was trying to be like a modern day Who Framed Roger Rabbit. But
I mean, Roger Rabbit is actually in it, isn't he, briefly? Like, I mean, I think you've seen him in a trailer. Yeah, I saw him in a trailer. I haven't seen the film yet, but
yeah, I mean, everyone's in it.
That they have.
any cartoon character you can think of is in it, pretty much. I think the main thing I struggle with is I couldn't really see who it was for. I mean, it seems skews a bit too old and kind of snarky and knowing for kids, but at the same time doesn't go quite far enough really to be like a truly sort of satirical adult movie. So if you grew up watching Chippendale, if you watch Rescue Rangers, I think you'll get something out of it. But yeah, I wasn't quite sure what the tone of it was. I felt like a lot of the laughs felt quite flat. I mean, I like Seth Rogen's bits were enjoyable. That whole sort of commentary on CGI, that's quite amusing. Kiki Lane's very appealing as always. She kind of gives it a bit of an anchor. But yeah, it did feel like they were trying to cram in so much. There's so much kind of going on in the background that it doesn't really sort of animate the foreground, to be honest.
The Ready Player One of like childhood animated films?
Yeah a little bit in that sense. Yeah, sort of cameo overload.
It was interesting what you said as well about it sort of falling between the two stools, like in terms of the adult and the child audience, because it's directed by Akiva Schaffer and Dale is voiced by Andy Samberg as well, isn't he? So there's very much a sort of Lonely Island vibe going on. So I was going to say how adult is it, you know, thinking of those two being involved.
But not sort of as funny as, like, you know, like the Lego movies, the way they kind of work on those two levels and have kind of involved Lonely Island as well. But I mean, I've seen some good reviews of it, so it could be just me. Certainly found the trailer was better than the movie.
Did you?
I feel like all the best stuff was crammed into the trailer. It's one of those for me.
I know that you're not recommending it, but I am now in my head planning a sort of double bill of 80 stars having to resentfully reunite to capture their former glory with the Bros documentary. I think that'd be a great double bill.
You should. That sounds like a good evening.
Yes, I know. And I because I was a big fan of the trailer as well, so I definitely will check it out. I mean, how did it work as well in terms of the blending of that 2D animation with the 3D? Did it work, or does it sort of look a bit ugly on the screen?
Yeah, I found that quite jarring. You know, it's sort of a nice gag at first that one of them had this, you know, the CGI surgery, because there are lots of kind of riffs on fame and trying to cling on to, you know, your past glories. But yeah, it didn't look quite right to me. It didn't look like they were sharing the same space. So to see, you know, to see these two buddies looking like they're in different movies. I did find that quite jarring, I have to say.
It works so well in that John Mulaney in the Spider-Verse, where he does the pig Spider-Man. So it's a shame they didn't recapture that glory.
Also because you've got all the live action elements as well. You know, you've got like live action Kiki Lane and CGI Dale and 2D Chip. Yeah, so I found it all a little bit much.
Also, Matthew was a bit disappointed by that, but if you fancy Chippendale Rescue Rangers, it premieres exclusively on Disney Plus from this Friday, May the 20th. So that's pretty much it for this week's episode. Next week, Jane Crowther's back on hosting duties. But before we go, there's time for one last question, which is, what movie scared you the most as a kid? Riffing on the scary children theme we were sort of talking about earlier here.
I grew up in Sudan where we didn't have like a watershed moment. So we would have like horror films on just on TV during the day. Like you could watch Hellraiser at 2 p.m. So I remember coming home from school and catching the last 30 minutes of Child's Play 2. And that traumatized me for many years, because obviously as a kid, you've got dolls everywhere and just worrying that they're going to turn on you. As actual kid films, Return to Oz was incredibly disturbing. An actual single moment, it's in Basil the Grace Mouse Detective, where there's an incredible jump scare where someone looks into a little cradle and there's a bat jumps out. And that was, I think, one of the great jump scares of cinema, to be honest. It's so scary.
I don't remember Basil the Great Mouse Detective that well, because I only sort of saw it once.
You repressed the memory.
Yeah, but I only saw it once in sort of adulthood, really. I think I was quite old by the time I saw it. But
that's it's quite dark.
That's made me tempted to revisit
it. For a Disney film.
Okay, what about you, Matthew?
Jaws, when it was first shown on TV. Yeah, I loved it in the moment. You know, I was perfectly swept up in it and thrilled by it. But when I went to bed, I was convinced there were sharks circling at the bottom of my bed and they were there all night. Yeah, that really freaked me. And also Blade Runner as well. I saw that when I was way too young. We rented the VHS and I was determined to see it because it had Han Solo in it. But yes, it was not a Star Wars sequel as I was perhaps anticipating. So yeah, Rutger Hauer still scares me as well.
For me, I'm going to go for, as a kid, one of the things I was most scared of in the kind of Disney film vein was in The Sword in the Stone, Mad Madam Mim from, you know, the end of that film.
Oh, yeah.
I was just so terrified when Wart is kind of turned into a sparrow, then he gets stuck in her house. I just found it so scary. And then also I'm going to throw to another film that you can actually see in some cinemas this week, which is RoboCop, which is getting a re-release. And again, that was, again, one of many films. I absolutely loved it and still do to this day, and saw it just far too young when I really sort of shouldn't have. But for the most part, I kind of enjoyed it without taking any of the sort of satire in or any of that. I just thought it was just a straightforward, you know, that action film. But I was quite disturbed by the sort of killing of Murphy early on. I just found something about that scene, even now, I don't know if it's just because it's the memory or what, but there's something sort of sadistic about it, and it's so dark, and Clarence is so sort of terrifying as a villain. That really kind of freaked me out, because I think, as a kid, I just thought it was like almost like a comic book movie, I suppose, you know, and it's weird because you obviously got there were lots of toys and things like that, you know, as well. So it was very much a thing that when I was young, kids were just very much aware of RoboCop, and he's kind of like a kid friendly looking character in a way that he looks sort of a bit like Iron Man or whatever. But I was very, very disturbed by that scene.
It's horrible. But I think it's also that practical effects of it. It feels very real, and it goes on for a really long time. I don't think you'd get that in an action film nowadays. No, maybe my answer is RoboCop now as well, actually. I've watched that YouTube video many times of like greatest deaths, because I almost can't believe it's real.
But weirdly, I wasn't so freaked out about the guy who gets dropped in the sort of toxic waste and then gets hit by a van. That I was sort of fine with that, but it was Murphy at the beginning I was most freaked out by. But yeah, so if you fancy revisiting that, that's sort of having a bit of a run around UK cinemas as well this weekend. So you can check that out on the big screen. So that's it from us today. Just literally time to say bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
See you next time.